Kushan emperors when they come to rule an empire in India. These are people who are Tokharian speakers who come off the steppes. We will see it in some of the early Turkish Khanates, and above all, in the Mongol Khanate. And this is just a pragmatic policy pursued by all steppe conquerors. In addition, they will exploit very much the Silk Road. The Parthians, by their conquests, have gained an important segment of the Silk Road, stretching from the modern city of Merv across the northern cities of Iran, notably Hamadan, ancient Ecbatana, Tabriz, also into the Roman Empire, where the goods would have been shipped ultimately to the Roman port of Antioch on the Mediterranean. And then on the eastern end, Merv, caravans would go into Central Asia across the Tarim Basin to China. That important trade route was now under the control of the Parthian kings, and they reaped great profits from it. And we'll be discussing in detail how this Silk Road, or Seidenstrasse, as it was first called in 1877, how this Silk Road becomes such an important, pivotal role in the economic life of the ancient and medieval world, and also the main avenue of cultural and religious exchange. And the Parthians played an important role there. They themselves did not engage in trade. It was largely their Sogdian and Aramaic-speaking merchants, their subjects, who did it, but they made it possible. The Parthians, however, had a major strategic problem. From the start, this state, and if you looked at the political world order in, the, say, the year 100 AD, there are four great Eurasian empires. One is the Han Empire of China. One is the Kushan Empire of Central Asia and North India coming up. The other is the Roman Empire in the Mediterranean world. And the fourth is the Parthian state. And it's really sandwiched in between what is the great Kushan Empire and the Roman Empire to the west. Those empires were exerting constant pressure on the Parthian state. The early migrations of the Sakai and the Tokharian speakers out of Central Asia into their future homes. It'll take both people eventually into India, but those migrations started in 140 BC when the Sakai pushed southwest from their homeland along the Jaxartes River, that is, into Transoxiana. They disrupted the Greco-Bactrian kingdom, and they eventually make their way through Afghanistan into western India. In fact, today, the Jats claim descent from the Sakai. Those are one of the warrior castes of India, favored by the British as a martial race. The Kushans, or the ancestors of the Kushans, those would be known as the Yuezhi in Chinese sources, the Tokoroi in Greek sources, or Tokharian. They pushed into the regions of Bactria, that is the former Greek kingdom, eventually would cross the Hindu Kush into northern India. Both the Tokharians and the Sakai defeated Parthian armies. At least two separate Parthian kings lost their lives battling these quote-unquote invaders. The one, Phraates II, who fell in probably in 128 BC, he fell fighting because he had hired a bunch of nomadic allies. They failed to turn up at the decisive battle, and then since they hadn't been paid, they were trashing the eastern frontier, and so the king rushed in, and of course he fell fighting these ancestors of the Kushans. So they felt pressure on their eastern frontier. On their western frontier, they faced a far more dangerous opponent, and that was Rome. In 69 BC, my favorite Roman commander, a man whom I study in my travels in Eastern Asia Minor, Lucius Licinius Lucullus, won the Battle of Tigranocerta in one of the great Roman victories. That battle made Rome the arbiter of the Middle East. Henceforth, Roman power stretched to the Euphrates. The Romans in 53 BC, under Crassus, Lucius Licinius Crassus, attempted to conquer the Parthian Empire. That ended in a disaster, a clades in Latin, in which the Suron, using a combination of heavy cavalry and horse archers, lured the legions of Crassus onto the battlefield, really an open plain, northeast of the modern city of Haran, today Carrhae, and essentially wiped out a Roman army of some 50,000, capturing the Roman legions. It was a major disgrace for the Romans, and it assured that the Parthians could keep the upper Euphrates as their frontier vis-a-vis Rome. It also taught the Romans to respect Parthian cavalry on the plains and grasslands of the Middle East and Iran, and also, above all, the high tableland of Armenia. That victory at Carrhae announced a new set of relationships between Rome and the Parthians. The Romans wanted revenge. Rome could never accept a defeat like this. And the Emperor Augustus, who after settling the so-called Roman Revolution and consolidating and creating the Roman Empire, in 20 BC preferred to negotiate rather than to invade. And by a diplomatic settlement in 20 BC, he regained the lost honor of Rome by recovering whatever captives were left from Carrhae, as well as the legionary standards. And at the same time, he received hostages from the then reigning king, King Phraates IV. Phraates IV sent a number of his sons, four of them, to be raised at Rome. He received in return a Greek courtesan known as Musa, Thea Urania Musa, the only lady to appear on Parthian coins, and from her he had his favorite son, Phraates V, who succeeded. Well, the diplomatic arrangement by Augustus suited both empires. The Parthians did not have the means to conquer Rome. The Romans, on the other hand, really didn't have the means to conquer the Parthians, although Rome in many ways was the superior power. And Rome, the diplomatic arrangements of Augustus were maintained for almost, 75 years, when in 54 AD, a war erupted between the ruling king of Parthia, Vologesus I, who tried to put his brother, Tiridates, on the throne of Armenia. And this led to a War of the Armenian Succession, as it's often called, and it too ended in a diplomatic settlement. The king of Armenia would be a Parthian prince crowned by Rome. Both states could rest satisfied that Armenia was protected. It was the borderland and the route between the two empires, as well as the entrance ramp for all those barbarians coming off that steppe highway over the Caucasus. And that was in the joint interests of the Romans and Parthians to maintain a peace settlement. There were successive wars against the Romans, against Trajan, Marcus Aurelius, Septimius Severus. These wars always favored the Romans who had the military edge. And the campaigns waged by Rome against the Parthians ultimately contributed to the undermining of the Arsacid state. In the meantime, the Romans picked up important real estate in the Middle East and emerged from these wars as the dominant power. And the weakening of the Parthian state in the end would come to plague the Romans, because in 227 AD, the Parthians were overthrown by a rebellion headed up by none other than their vassal king of Persia, a man named Ardashir. He defeated and slew the last Parthian king, Artabanes V, and proclaimed a new Neo-Persian Empire, or Sassanid Empire, a bureaucratic state that was Zoroastrian in faith and committed to the reconquest of all of the domains of the older Persian Empire, including the eastern half of the Roman world. And the Romans were far better off dealing with Parthians than they ever were with the Sassanid Shahs. Well, in summing up the Parthian achievement, there are two significant points I would like to stress. First, they were remarkably versatile and successful. For 400 years, they ruled Iran and the wider Middle East from horseback. They are very, very difficult to fit in the current national histories. They were not Zoroastrians. They really weren't Iranians. They were interlopers. But by a judicious combination of diplomacy vis-a-vis the Romans and the Kushans, by promoting the Silk Road through their domains, and coming to terms with the existing populations, they had ruled the first nomadic empire in the Near East from the steppes, and in so doing, unwittingly provided a model for the later and more successful nomads from the steppes, the Seljuk Turks.
Lecture 7, Kushans, Sakai, and the Silk Road.
In this lecture, I plan to look at two new nomadic peoples. The first are the Sakai, and the second are best known under the name Kushans, and they have a number of other names in classical and Chinese sources. We're going to have to recall that while the Parthian kings, the Arsacid kings of Parthia, were conquering Iran and Mesopotamia, there were movements to the east of them in Transoxiana and ultimately in India, and they were conducted by these two contemporary nomadic peoples. The migrations of the Sakai and the Tocharians proves to be extremely important. For one, it is the first of what I like to call a domino effect. That is, the Tocharian speakers, who were known in Chinese sources as the Yuezhi or the Yuezhi, they use both terms, were driven west, having been defeated in the mid-second century BC. They smashed into the Sakai, who were dwelling more or less in the valley of the Jaxartes in Ferghana, and the Sakai then moved about 140 BC into Transoxiana and ultimately ended up in India. And then about a decade later, these Tocharian speakers essentially followed the route of the Sakai, and they too will ultimately end up in India. And this is a pattern that will repeat itself. Later, we will see that with the Huns, the Hephthalites, various Turkish tribes, the Karakitans. It is the changes of the political dynamics between the Chinese Empire and nomads on the eastern steppes will invariably have repercussions sending peoples west. Now, the other important thing, point about these migrations, it led to the rise of important kingdoms in India, particularly the second migration, the great Kushan emperors, and that will have profound consequences for Buddhism and also the emergence of the Silk Road, two subjects we'll be talking about later in this course. First, let's take a look at the Sakai. They entered into our urban literate civilization sooner than the Tocharian speakers. The Sakai are an Iranian-speaking people. Classical sources usually identify them with the Scythians. We have depictions of them as early as the reign of King Darius, the great Persian emperor who set up the Behistun rock, where the Sakai are shown being brought into submission. They undoubtedly had been dwelling on the central steppes since the early Iron Age, let's say from about 900 to 600 BC. Some of the Sakai had moved east and southeast. We know that some entered the Tarim Basin. They settled in the regions of the southwestern corner of the Tarim Basin, particularly around the city of Khotan. And later documents, much later documents, prove there's an East Iranian language being spoken there as well as Tocharian. The DNA testing of Tarim Basin mummies have shown there was probably an Iranian component in the population. We discussed that evidence earlier, where the very early mummies seem to point to Indo-European speakers coming from the West. And furthermore, these Sakai, being nomads, were very, very adept at horseback riding and may well have been involved in the early domestication of the Bactrian camel, that is, the two-humped camel that becomes so important in the trade of the Silk Road. Again, a subject coming up in a future lecture. The Sakai established a symbiosis with the cities of Sogdia and Bactria. Those are the two districts of Transoxiana in the ancient period, and they're essentially the north and the south sections of Transoxiana. The Sogdians lived in, they're also an Iranian-speaking people. They lived in towns, particularly oasis towns. They were engaged in farming. They inhabited an important city called Marakanda, which is the predecessor but not identical to later Samarkand. Bactria was at the south end of Transoxiana. It was the upper valley of the Oxus River. It was heavily, densely populated with cities and agriculture. And these two areas were collectively called the Upper Satrapies. They came under the control of Alexander the Great in 329-328 BC, and Alexander quickly had to learn, as the previous Persian kings learned, and as later Arab emirs who were trying to run this area in the 8th and 9th centuries, that the only way to secure Transoxiana is to win the elites of the cities, merchant princes, and also you can't set up a frontier barrier. You can regulate the movement of the nomads. You can't stop it. Alexander initially tried to set up fortifications on the Jaxartes. That would have prevented the Sakai from crossing over and engaging in the typical trade with the cities and the agriculturalists of Transoxiana. It just destroyed the pattern. And when those cities rebelled against Alex, they called in their nomadic allies. And again, this is a common pattern in Transoxiana, starting in the antiquity and really running down through the Mongol period and beyond. The caravan cities of Transoxiana are in close association with the nomads on the central steppes. And the relationship between Alexander and the Sakai underscore it. Now, I discussed earlier that Alexander's empire broke up, that a general of his called Seleucus took over the eastern domains. And then in 250 BC, a governor of this Seleucid empire, that is the descendants of the general Seleucus, usurped power in the upper satrapies. He's known as Diodotus. He was a Greek. He styled himself as a king at Bactra. That is the city of Balkh today. It's the capital of Bactria. Bactria is the country. Bactra is the capital city on the Oxus. And he ruled as a Hellenistic king in the fashion of the great kings such as the Ptolemies, known through Cleopatra of Antony and Cleopatra fame, and the Seleucids in the West and lesser dynasts. We know about these Greek kings largely through their coins and just snippets of information from the Greek historians. However, what is clear, especially from archaeology, is there were a number of Greek-style cities in Bactria and then in Sogdiana, that is the northern section of Transoxiana, places such as Marakonda, the Sogdian merchant princes held sway. Well, whether they were Sogdian, that is Iranian-style cities or Greek cities, they needed contact with the steppes. They needed the interaction with those Sakai. The Sakai were selling horses and camels. We have on Greco-Bactrian coins beautiful examples of the horses of Fergana. Those are the horses that are known in Chinese sources as the heavenly horses that sweat blood. They later become the objective of a number of important Chinese diplomatic and military efforts. These horses are depicted on the coins of several Greco-Bactrian kings, and they are the steeds upon which the Dioscuri, Castor and Pollux, are riding. And they are unmistakably the same horses, the horses that are also depicted in Tang art. And so this was probably a major lucrative trade between the Sakai and the Greco-Bactrian kings. Well, somewhere around 145-140 BC, this whole symbiosis fell apart. The Sakai were suddenly forced to quit their homes, and they migrated into Transoxiana. They probably came from several routes. There's speculation. One group came directly over the Hindu Kush through the Khyber Pass. Another group clearly swung around in a wide arc, crossing the Jaxartes, disrupting the Bactrian kingdom, probably sacking cities, destroying agricultural fields. They ended up on the borders of what is today southeastern Iran, the region of Sestan. Actually, it takes his name from the Sakai, Sestan, Baluchistan. They made their way up to Kandahar, crossed the Bolan Pass, and descended into the Indus Valley. Now, these migrations were a catastrophe for the Greek cities. There were Greek cities at this point not only in Bactria, but also in northern India. These all trace their origins back to colonies of Alexander the Great. And many of these cities fell to the Sakai. And so the Sakai are probably responsible for extinguishing the political legacy of Alexander the Great. On the other hand, they embraced the Hellenistic culture a great deal. And as we shall see, their successors, the people who followed them, that is the Kushans, the people who put them in motion in the first place, these Tokharian speakers, they would take the same route. They would be very, very favorable to the Hellenic arts and letters and aesthetics. We have limited information about these Sakai. Sometimes they're called Indo-Sakai or Indo-Scythians. We do have a number of coins, and the coins are a strange mixture of both Greek and Indian elements in their iconography. One of the most important kings we know from his coins is Aziz. He ruled perhaps from 57 BC somewhere down to around 30 BC. And actually, his accession date Still remembered today in many Buddhist communities because it's used as the date of reckoning. It's known as the Vikrama era, or sometimes just the Sakha era. So undoubtedly, the Sakai had a big impression on the Buddhist community in India. Well, let's turn to the fellows who are pushing the Sakai into Transoxiana in India. And that takes us to one of the most remarkable of the early empires of the steppes, the Kushans. It's remarkable in several reasons because in order to reconstruct it, we have to use a bizarre range of sources. And as we look at the Kushans, we're going to start on the confines of the Chinese Empire and the extreme western ends of the Chinese Empire. And these Tokharian speakers are first being discussed in Chinese sources, and eventually they're going to move west. They get noticed by the Greek sources, and they end up essentially being discussed in Buddhist sources. Particularly their greatest emperor, Kanishka, who ruled in the early 2nd century AD and was remembered as a convert to Buddhism. Now, the best guess is, and this, it's not a guess anymore, it's now pretty conclusively accepted, and in earlier academic literature, and we'll find out in a moment why this was why it was not so certain, the nomadic peoples known as the Yuezhi or the Yuezhi, both forms are found, were people on the western borders of China. They were just above the Gansu corridor. They had been in very early contact with China, had absorbed a great deal of Chinese civilization. It is speculated that these people were perhaps behind the earliest trade, especially in jade, from the Tarim Basin around Khotan to the early Shang emperors, then later the Zhou dynasty. And they were still an important force in the time of the Han. As you recall, the Han is really the first great Chinese empire. Well, the Qin established it, but the Han Empire is looked upon as the epitome of the first great early Chinese empire. And these Tokharian speakers were very, very formidable. Our diplomat from the Emperor Wu Di, Zhang Jian, makes his way to these people, the Yuezhi. He finally contacts him in 128 BC after about 10 years with his Shuang new wife, and he reports to us that these are a great power. They have 100,000 to 200,000 horse archers. And that's why the Emperor Wu Di is interested in courting these guys. He wants to use them as allies against the Shuang new, and with good reason. When Zhang Jian contacted these Tokharian speakers, they were dwelling in Fergana. They had gone very, very far west, and the reason for that is the Shuang Nu had pushed them there. Modu Chanyu, the great organizer of the Shuang Nu Confederacy, had it in for these rivals. He is known to have defeated them. He turned the head of his defeated UHC opponent into a goblet. And there were a number of defeats which steadily drove these Tokharian speakers west out of the orbit of China and essentially into Transoxiana. And once these people showed up in Transoxiana, they then pushed the Sakai south and southeast into India and into Transoxiana in eastern Iran. Your domino effect. Well, I mentioned that once the these people got there, and we can now start calling them the Tokharoi because they now come into the view of Greek sources or Tokharians, the term that links them to those later Buddhist texts in the Tarim Basin. These Tokharians very, very quickly take over the Greek cities of Bactria, and they begin issuing coins. They embrace a lot of the Hellenic culture, and they follow some of the same route as the Sakai. We have some information about them. They clearly were a confederation of some five tribes, and these tribes had some kind of partnership in which there was a rotating, essentially, chairman of the board among the tribal rulers. They probably held a title equivalent to the later Turkish title, Yabgu. The Greeks translate that title apparently as tyrant, tyrannos. It's a title that loosely means prince. It's not really a royal title. One of these early rulers issued coins in the Greek style. His name is Hieraios in Greek. The coins are in Greek. And it shows a man clearly from the steppes. he actually shows this ritual deforming of the head as a child to give you a high forehead from the portrait. This is later reported to be done by the Huns and various Turkish peoples and confirms that these Tokharians are clearly steppe nomadic peoples who've entered into Transoxiana, that is Bactria. Up until recently, we were really in the dark how these nomads turned themselves into the Kushan emperors. And here we got an unusual set of sources that have come to our assistance, because up until this time, we depended on very, very limited sources. And the key source in this is an important inscription, an inscription that was found in 1993. It was found near the site of Rabatak. Rabatak is a town in Afghanistan today. It's on an old trade route to India. It's a monumental inscription. It weighs something like half a ton, and it's currently in the Kabul Museum. This inscription was set up by the Kushan Emperor Kanishka I, the great emperor regarded as a convert to Buddhism. And in it, the document is very, very important. It gives us a list of the Kushan emperors. Kanishka names his successors. And in this list, there are four important emperors' names. The first is Kuchula Kadphises, who ruled in the early 1st century AD. Then the man who is his son, a man that we weren't quite sure of before until we got this inscription. His name is Vima Taktu. Then another king known as Vima Kadphises. And finally, Kanishka himself. And from other sources, we know that Kanishka's son is Huvishka, who followed. All of a sudden, we have a sequence of five emperors, and from what we can tell, this is a succession from father to son. These emperors collectively stretched from most of the 1st and 2nd century AD. They are contemporary with the Roman emperors from Tiberius to Marcus Aurelius. They had very long reigns. The inscription is informative in other ways. It tells us, for instance, that Kanishka switched from the official language of Greek to an Aryan language, by which he might mean Bactrian, an Iranian language. Some have speculated maybe a vernacular of Sanskrit. But whatever it is, this was the first conscious effort in the early 2nd century AD to create a more Kushan empire without depending on Greek. Furthermore, the inscription tells us that Kanishka set up images to his ancestors to worship, that the various ancient Iranian gods were invoked, particularly the goddess Nana. This is a revelation, because if you depended just on the Buddhist text, you would think that these emperors were strict Buddhists, and they are clearly not. And the inscription proved a very, very important discovery. It wasn't translated until a couple of years later. It's in the Kabul Museum, and there's a lot of fears about what might happen to it in the fighting going on there right now. In addition to the inscription, and the inscription really becomes our baseline, we have a gallery of portraits of these emperors on stunning coins, particularly gold coins. They start issuing gold coins in the reign of Vima Kadphises. And the coins are marvelous because they now match up with the inscription. We know the sequence of these emperors. And what the coins give us are a portrait gallery of Kushan emperors. And you have to realize we have very little other sources about these men. And in addition, the reverses of the coins carry various gods and inscriptions. The coins are very, very revealing, and they dovetail with that inscription beautifully. For one, looking at how these emperors depict themselves, they are very often with halos. They're carrying ceremonial maces. Sometimes they're portraits, sometimes they're standing figures at sacrifice, and the inscriptions are in both Greek and the so-called Kharoshthi script, which is used to write a vernacular Sanskrit. They're bilingual,